Greetings, and welcome to Flanagan's Ecologic. I am your host, Ted Flanagan, and today I'm joined by Faridun Shiosansi. He's a gentleman and a scholar. He's also one of the most prolific authors in the energy space that I know. He's the publisher of a newsletter, the EE Informer. He's worked all over the world helping to promote utilities and advance them into becoming integrated companies, now integrating distributed energy resources into the grid. So we're going to have a great conversation. Delighted to have Faridun Shiosansi on the podcast today. Faridun, welcome to the podcast. It's very good to see you.
Thank you.
And what are you working on right now? What's this week's project for you?
Good question. I actually make a list of things on my high priority items for the day. And just to answer your question, I'm actually registering for a conference, hybrid systems for small, remote, isolated islands, which I've been attending for several years now. And they always hold these in very small, very remote islands. And as you can imagine, these islands have particular challenges with energy because most of them traditionally brought in, fossil fuels, oil and diesel from far away, very expensive. They're small systems. So they end up with super expensive electricity, which is typically subsidized by somebody or the mainland. And now, but they've discovered recently that, hey, they have wind, they have sun, some of them, depending on where they are, and they have hydro, and they have geothermal in some cases, tidal energy, all kinds of renewables. And so just like Hawaii is trying to go 100% renewable, these islands are trying to go, and it makes perfect sense. And the technology's almost there. And so I enjoy that. That's on top of my list. And after that, I think on Friday, I'm flying to Sardinia in Italy. And I'm going to teach a master class, which I've done before. So these are students typically taking, engineers taking electrical engineering stuff, but they're preparing for a career in the electricity sector. And most of them know how electricity flows, how it's generated, so forth, but they don't know electricity markets or consumers, or typically don't know about things that are happening at the customer end, which are quite revolutionary, as you know. So I try to open their minds and maybe change their careers a little bit, stuff like that. So it's super exciting. And what I do at this particular instance, I invite a number of guest lecturers. So I talk about a theory of, let's say, the need to redesign electricity markets, which one of your prior speakers focused on. So I give them the fundamentals, which is probably boring, and they get, they fall asleep. And then they invite a guest speaker who's actually trying to do it. And the students wake up and actually kind of put the theory and the practice together. So it's a successful way of teaching the course. And then at the end of the week, actually, while I'm in Sardinia, I happen to be talking to a group of people in Malaysia, Kuala Lumpur, and they have a, I guess, someone from Ministry of Energy or someone. They're interested in a pathway for introducing and supporting distributed energy resources about which they know little. And they reached out and said, hey, we know you've done work in this area, so come and tell us what it means and what it will do to the distribution network. And so that's enough for one day, I would think.
That's a great collage, and it speaks to your career. I mean, as a professor, as a teacher, this master class, the students must be getting tremendous insights from you. Perry, how many countries have you worked in now? I did a little bit of poking around, and it just seems like you've worked in dozens of countries around the world. Is that a fair number?
Yeah,
you have a number.
I think I have. It's probably more than three dozen. I mean, it's quite a few, but some of the engagements are small. You know, I go and visit, maybe give a talk, or maybe talk to some experts, or maybe help them. Sometimes it's sponsored by the World Bank, or you know, somebody else is footing the bill. So it's just a matter of getting out there and spreading the word. But yeah, I've lost count of countries, but I think it's probably more than three dozen, less than 50, or somewhere in that zone.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you're obviously very entrepreneurial. You've had Menlo Energy Economics for decades, right? And you've been doing jobs all over the world. Would you characterize yourself, if you had to give an elevator pitch, as energy economics or utility structuring, or how would you define the your focus at Menlo Energy Economics?
You know, having been around as many years as I have, and having worked at the utility, EPRI, Electric Power Research Institute, number of consulting companies, large and small, I think I have a good perspective on the energy sector. But, you know, electricity has been my passion all these years. So without super exaggerating, I think I get a good sense of the whole value chain, you know, from where the fuel comes and how it's turned into electrons and how it's transmitted and distributed and what happens when customers get it. And now, of course, there's a lot of interest in what do customers do when they get it. And now some of the customers, as you know, they're now turning the tables on the utilities. They're producing and storing and feeding back the grid, and that's causing problems. And a lot of people are not happy about it. But so if I were to give the elevator pitch, I would say, you know, I can kind of connect the dots. And also, because I've seen the changes, I'm you know, I see the energy transition, I see the electrification, the rise of, you know, distributed resources, and all the interesting companies that are pushing the envelope in terms of new business models. And I'm now dabbling in assisting and advising in some of the startups that are trying to enter the business. They typically have a good solution in search of a client and an application. And so sometimes I try to bring the people that have the mouse trap with the person that is trying to get rid of the mouse, you know.
It sure is a rich time in our utility industry, isn't it? I mean, the old days of the single power plant and the single directional relation from, you know, kilowatt hours being sold to consumers, and now we have a whole bi-directional, a whole new framework. And as a consultant, it's just fascinating. You know, you and I met, we were just talking about this, we met at EPRI back in the early 90s, and we were both working on something that was called DSM, demand side management. And do you think that DSM was sort of and that was part of the integrated resource planning, least cost utility planning? Maybe it was really the beginning of the end of the classic, you know, utility model, right? It was all of a sudden now we're shifting to the customer's side of the meter and starting to adjust demand, not just simply provide more capacity. Was that your perspective, that this was sort of, we were kind of getting the, you know, the camel's nose under the tent? You know, it was a new era was beginning in the utility sector, I seem to me.
No, you're spot on. I moved from Southern California Edison, where the business was to sell more, to EPRI, where people were saying, well, maybe we shouldn't be pushing more sales and think about customers using energy more efficiently. It was a you know, total flip, both in terms of culture, in terms of mission. But no, those you know, DSM days, the early DSM days, were, you know, the utilities were for the first time offered incentives to sell less rather than more, the kinds of stuff that Amory Lovins was and continues to talk about, and which is still a challenge. You know, how do you teach an old dog a new trick? You know, utilities are still under rate of return regulation. They prefer to invest in hardware, steel in the ground, you know, underground pipes, you know, transmission line, whatever they can do, you know, that's their mindset. And yep. they put in a great base and people are, you know, people pay, you know, that has not changed fundamentally. And it shocks me. I have a friend, a neighbor who has a big roof with solar panels, battery, EV, and so forth. And he was telling me that for 92% of the hours in a year, 92% of 87, 76, that's a lot of hours, he does not need the distribution utility.
That's pretty good.
So 8% of the time, yes, he does.
And you can see why this is threatening to the utility industry, right? We have these regulators allowing for net energy metering, and then look what's happening.
Exactly. You go to the utility and say, what are you going to do if you have a million of these guys? And they're coming.
Yeah, they are coming.
And we have high rates in California. You know that better than I do, and they keep going up. So even if the utility doesn't pay anything for the excess, people will still figure out a way to store it and use it at night when it's even more expensive, you know, and charge their electric vehicle. Yeah. And so forth and so on. And to go even a step further, I just met somebody last week at another event, and he runs an off-grid farm in Mendocino County. And he says he has a backup generator for those rare occasions that sun is not shining and the battery is empty. And he's probably more than 90% of the hours operating yep. totally independent of the grid. So these are interesting times. And I think maybe anticipating your next question is, you know, what is the future of distribution business? My last edited book, and what do these network operators do? You know, we don't want them, because we still need them for the even those people that don't need them 92% of the time, they need them for 8% of the time. So we got to figure out a way to maintain that network. And in fact, upgraded and so forth, but how are we going to pay for it?
Yeah. And I think Brian Hennigan, who is one of the contributors to the book that you edited, who is a friend of mine, and he's general manager of Holy Cross Energy out in Colorado, where I have a home. You know, he talks about the future being a whole bunch of network microgrids, so that you have the microgrids providing the resilience in the communities and, you know, tapping the local renewables, and then being networked together. Like you said, there's a tremendous value in the networking and the resilience that creates. But this is all speaking to this just a crazy new utility model. Perry, I always wondered, why didn't the utilities get into selling rooftop solar themselves? I mean, why would we allow, and I know what Tokyo Electric has, other utilities have done this. If the consumers want the rooftop solar, you know, why didn't our utilities give them that instead of creating this whole industry of, you know, solar cities and Sunruns and all these other companies?
I think you asked this question. I've been listening to some of your other podcasts. I think this is
one of my favorite questions.
Be asked and don't get the good answer. I think it's the regulatory paradigm that we find ourselves in.
Yeah.
It you know, utilities look at distributed energy resources as a sort of bad thing to tolerate. And when people put in solar panels, they see the lost revenues. They go to the commission and ask for higher rates, which they typically get. And what does that do? That just convinces more people to figure out a way
that
around
spiral,
it.
Right? Yeah, that spiral.
And it's really difficult. And some people are critical of utilities and regulators, but I often ask them, if you were in their shoes, what would you do? If you were you were the chair of the California Public Utilities Commission and you saw this future, well, how would you go around it? It's not easy. It's not just a little fix, adding a little fixed charge, things like that. It's just not going to cut it. We really need to step out of the proverbial box and think about this future. And then think, as some people have said, another contributor to one of my books is Lorenzo Kristov. You might have heard of him.
Yep. I know.
He thinks, if he were to redesign the electricity network today, we would start with DERs at the center and then build the utility around it. And I'm kind of convinced of this. I think that the paradigm shift that people talk about is as follows. We are moving from central role for the utilities to a residual role, where they fill the 8%. We should try to get more people to be the 92, when they don't need the network, for 92%, because it makes a lot of sense, frankly. And then build the network for the 8% of the hours.
And if they'd be largely out of the generation business, right? They'd be really providing that network, being the broker of the flow of electrons.
And we need it, we need the balancing and all the services that the network provides. And we are, to answer your question, in countries like Australia, where you have distribution companies separated from retail companies, you are beginning to see innovation taking place at the retail end, where the retailer comes and says, okay, I see that you guys are doing this anyway, so let me help you do it better and cheaper because I have better access to capital costs and so forth and so on. And in California, to their credit, I think the CCAs, the customer choice aggregators, are beginning to do it as well, because they have incentives. If they don't have to pay as much to procure energy to serve their customers, that saving is directly passed on to the consumers. The IOUs, because of the regulatory paradigm that we operate in, don't have that incentives. So you go to the utility CEO and say, why aren't you doing it? Then maybe they'll tell you why they're not doing it, because it doesn't make any sense for them to do it.
You remember John Rowe, who was the head of head of Central Maine Power, and then he went to New England Electric. I think then he went to Exelon, but He gave that great talk. I'm a utility executive. I'm a rat. Wherever the biggest piece of cheese is for me to go to, if it's building more power plants, fine. If it's investing in demand side management, fine. Yeah. But I'm just going to be operating in a very simple, opportunistic mode. Perry, I wanted to talk a little bit about your newsletter. You are one of the most prolific writers, I think, out there. And I worked with Amory Lovins, who is just an amazingly prolific person, but your newsletter is incredible. It is the EE Informer. It's monthly. You've published it for years. I want to hear more about it. You've got a circulation. How on earth do you have the energy to put to all that research and writing every month?
Well, yeah, no, thanks. It's I've been doing it for 34 years, which is longer than many marriages and so forth. So it's turned into, frankly, it's my passion and hobby, but it's super rewarding. The same with the books that I've edited. I've done 15 and now I'm working on number 16. So the books gives me networking opportunity. I get to work with the Hennigans and the Flanagans and the, Kristovs and so forth.
The Czars and Robigos
and all these people who wouldn't otherwise, have time to deal with me. The newsletter, sort of in a perverse way, does the same. It forces, the fact that you have to, and you do your newsletter, and I read it with interest, the fact that I have to do it forces me, you know, average person gets something in the news and they may click on it or they may not. I get something in the news and I read it. And if it's good, I store it, I save it, I make notes on it. And then at the end of the month, I sit down and say, oh, gee, all this avalanche of developments, what did I learn? Does it make any sense? Does it, you know, does A link to B and leads me to Z, or does it just, and believe it or not, if you do that systematically and connect the dots, you get the ahas. You can see that we are, you know, energy transition is taking place. You see that industry is cleaning up its act. You see that distributed resources are making a difference, and so forth and so on. So the newsletter is as time consuming as it is, it's super rewarding, because at the end of the day, I learn so much because I have to do the homework. And of course, if somebody reads it and subscribes, that's even better. But that's
then they can't. You probably get all sorts of comments. I know. Another thing that you probably do that I've been doing is, if I'm ever chatting with somebody professionally or personally on a topic that I just don't know about, you know, I'm sort of flat foot. I don't understand this. I go, that's going to be an article in my next month's newsletter, because I'm going to learn about that. That people are curious about these things. So, but in this last newsletter, I looked at the ascent of electrification. Just talk about a couple of the articles, and you had a picture of General Electric's first steel only fridge, and I didn't understand the steel only. What is that all about?
Well, I think that was 1929 at from GE. Yeah, I always sometimes get nostalgic looking, you know, that was before I was born, but electrification, you know, obviously started long before. Now we're doing it for different reasons. If you scroll in the newsletter towards the end, there's an article on nuclear, and then I have a photo of the first nuclear reactor, which was built in 1956.
In England, right? I read that was England. Fascinating.
Yeah.
In England, and I had no idea.
There's also a picture of Louis Strauss with Eisenhower. For those who have watched the Oppenheimer movie, quite a bit of the movies about this character. He's the famous guy that said nuclear would be so too cheap to meter, if you remember. So electrification is now the topic of my next edited book. So what's happening, which you are well aware of, is basically, you know, the way to climate salvation is to electrify everything and anything that we can, provided that it's the energy source is renewable. So I tell people, you know, climate change is complicated, but it really can be done in two steps. First, electrify and make sure all the electricity is renewable. And that's what this book is about. And the GE ad is just an example of different reasons that when appliances became available in the early 1900s, when electricity, you know, first people wanted lighting, but then they wanted refrigeration, then they wanted fans, then they wanted radios, and, you know, everything else. So it that was a different era. But now we're electrifying not so much because we're just trying to substitute for dirtier fuels in heating and, you know, other applications where heat pumps and electric hot water heaters and so forth make good sense.
And where do you stand on the nuclear issue? Obviously, advocates of nuclear are saying it's an important element in decarbonization, and others like me are opposed to nuclear for all of its long-term threats to society. But where do you stand?
I would say I'm a nuclear fan, you know, but I think it's the technology that we fumbled along the way. You know, all new technologies you look at, they come along and they're tested, and we scale up and we learn more and the cost goes down, and we build more and the cost goes even further down, and pretty soon it's too cheap to meter. Yeah. Nuclear went the other way. We started building more. We started building bigger ones. And none of that happened. It takes longer to build one. It costs a fortune. It's still, you can argue that if somebody has free money, free capital or low interest capital to give away, then yeah, it's still, the operating cost is low. Yeah, there are risks, but as you know, Ted, there's nothing, there's no free lunch. Every technology you look at has some side effects. You know, there's nothing, there's no free lunch, frankly. So in that,
right,
if viewed in that term, I don't think nuclear is evil. I don't have anything fundamentally against it. And frankly, I was hoping that this SMRs, the small modular reactor that they were trying to build in Idaho would come along, and maybe that would give us some hope that it can be done. But yeah, unfortunately, even that didn't pan out. So we're back to square one. And nuclear proponents don't give up. economics doesn't look good in systems where private investors have to take the risk and put up the money. So we can see that clearly. It's a story where you could go back and say it could have been different. You know, we could have managed this better. And I don't want to get into all the details and pros and cons,
I was at New York Power Authority, my first job out of grad school, and was a strategic planner. And we ran two nuclear plants at the Power Authority. And they were both managed by retired Admiral Paul Early, who was in, you know, Rickover's nuclear Navy. And he ran, I think, those power plants like the Navy runs, you know, the reactors on their ships, which is taking them very, very seriously. I hear what you said about I concur. The nuclear industry sort of bungled its delivery. And now the nuclear costs are just exorbitant. And of course, solar, I just read solar was the biggest source of new capacity last year. I mean, it's just phenomenal what's going on with solar energy. What about balance in your life? We've talked about the writing the newsletter, writing the books, networking, you know, professionally, stimulating your brain. You've obviously made huge contributions, working in all of these countries around the world and helping to shape their transition towards a cleaner energy future. What do you do for balance? What advice do you have for people?
I'm actually probably the last person you want to get advice on that particular issue. I'm a single-minded, single purpose. I can't do multitasking. I don't have very many hobbies. This has been my passion and my career and so forth. The problem I have, I am trying to actually do a little more of that, reading more. I'm traveling quite a bit. Previously, you know, there was this course in Sardinia, I would go and teach my 4 or 5 days and hurry back. And now I don't do that. I go to Sicily for a week and, you know, whatever. So I do a bit of that. But the challenge for me at this point in life is, how do I remain somewhat engaged and relevant? Because everything is moving so fast. It's not optional. You can't do your newsletter every other week or every other month or cut down a few pages here and there. You either have to be on top of things or nobody wants to listen to you anymore.
Yeah.
You know, it's a dilemma. I am struggling at my old age to figure out an easy exit. To find that balance, I find reading. I spend more time. I like biography and history and things like that, and I enjoy talking to other people who know more about things that I'm interested in. So I try to. That's as much as balance that I can do is not spend all the time behind the computer and But it's so rewarding. It's I frankly, I wouldn't know what to do if I didn't do some of the things that I do.
Yeah. Well, thanks for what you do. Thanks for what you do. You obviously made fantastic contributions. And, you know, that shift towards academia, I had Russell Sturm on the show recently. Chris Caldwell was just on the show. And you know, reaching these points in their careers where, you know, they realize that it's training the next generation, right? It's getting the next generation ready to carry on with the challenges that we've been so involved with. So thank you so much. Thanks for being on the podcast.
Thank you for having me. And I've enjoyed listening to a few of your podcasts in anticipation of this. And some of them were really brilliant. My last comment is, compared to some of your other guests, my contributions are probably minimal, but
I don't know about that. You're kind and humble. We'll do it again.
Good talking with you. Bye.
That's it. Thanks for listening to Flanagan's Ecologic. We'll see you next time.